Hello, and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is the founder and editor of TELUS News, longtime Washington journalist Ryan Lizza. Now, remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you are from. You also can get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us, remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Naked Wines and NPR, in our show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It helps make this podcast happen. Okay, the 100-day marker, James. Trump calls it the most important ever. Atlantic, in a good piece, said it's consequential. I agree. It's very consequential in a very negative way. The central markers, I think, if you look at it over 100 days, he inherited one of the best economies in our lifetime. First quarter showed negative growth. Maybe a little statistical quirk, but it is really it's the canary in the coal mine. We are the economy, which he inherited, which was so good. He is in the process of if not destroying, certainly taking down. He set historic records for incompetence. Pete Hegseth, we've never had a more incompetent defense secretary, a danger to national security. Only question is when they have to dump him. RFK Jr. at HHS is endangering lives. The Justice Department is a department that only believes in justice for the Trump world and seeking retribution against any of his perceived enemies. I really think all this is undeniable. He's shown contempt for the rule of law. He's seriously damaged alliances, which we can talk about later. But James, the central question I think you should ask, even after 100 days, is what has he done to improve the lives of any Americans? A lot of bombast, a lot of boasting, but he went out to Michigan. But that welder in Macomb or Oakland counties, how is his or her life any better than it was 100 days ago? It's not. Now, polls virtually across the board are bad. And he always underperforms, I know, when he can bounce back. I think this time is different. I think that people are catching on to him. His policies are creating. This is all self-inflicted. You know, it has been a consequential presidency, James. But in that short time, he's taken us to a very dark place that's going to take us a while to get out of.
Well, you're right. And the real tragedy here is you can have fluctuations in people's lives. You can have fluctuations in the economy. Of course, this is not anything. This is no fluctuation. This was all done by Donald Trump, his policies, and his big, stupid mouth. So the United States has had a bad 101 days. Let's be very very clear on that. And, you know, they talk about, well, remember, Kevin Hassett, Trump's chief economic advisor, the head of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, said in February that he expected 2.5% growth in the first quarter. So if you don't even know what you're doing, if the people advising you have no idea what's going on around him. And now you have all this kind of rush to say, well, could be some statistical noise. I don't know if it's really, you know, down 0.3% because the imports, it was bad. It was really bad. And, you know, the markets are not buying it, clearly. The usual apologetic brigade, or we'll have it say, but I have a question. I'm willing to ask this question. Third quarter. Why is third quarter really big? Well, it matters growth. The GDP numbers matter a lot to markets. It actually reflects me right. The third quarter number is going to be reported at the end of October. What happens at the beginning of November? Virginia and New Jersey governor. We need a blowout. So the numbers speak for themselves, and let Kevin Hassett keep running his ignorant, stupid, fat mouth, predicting 2.5% growth. We don't even know where he is. He's advising on something he has no understanding, no appreciation of. They got these clowns, buffoons, idiots, Howard Lutnick. I mean, good God almighty. So we're in a tough go here. We're just in a tough go. And it's been a bad 100 days, 101 days. And I don't think the next 201 going to get any better.
Yeah, you're right. Because look ahead. Those tariffs, which hurt a teeny bit in the first quarter, they really haven't started to bite yet. They will bite. Even if he starts to, you know, throw in the white flag, they're going to bite. And they're going to hurt a lot more in the months ahead. That's got to hurt his poll ratings even more. And when it comes to the budget, Congress hasn't cut a dime. They've said, we're going to. This is our plan. They haven't told you how. So in the months ahead, they face the dilemma of trying to extend tax cuts for the rich while cutting Medicaid. That is a disaster for them. And whatever they do, it's only, I just can't see what's the bright spot for him in the months ahead.
Well, the Democrats can make it really big. So let's talk about rope-a-dope. Now remember, rope-a-dope lasted till about the sixth round, right? Mm-hmm. Then George Foreman was exhausted in the rumble in the jungle. Then it kicked in, okay? The rope-a-dope era is over. He's exhausted. His numbers are down. He took them down himself. Now we have two things that can define the Democratic Party, and there has to be unanimity on this, and there has to be unanimity of messaging. Fight the tax cut, the corporate tax cuts. In fact, you could even talk about raising the corporate tax slightly if you wanted to, but fine. Talk about tax cuts for people making over $400,000 a year. Talk about how much the deficit is, how much that's going to cost young people. It's $4.5 trillion. This is not chump change. Then link this, and this is very important. You have to link. They're going after diabetes research. Yes, that's correct. They did. They cut a grant to the University of Michigan that Bobby can't even know about. They're completely decimating the weather service when we're going to have a active hurricane here. God knows what we have in tornadoes and fires and all the other crap we got coming. And now they're going to go after ordinary people, middle-income, low middle-income people's health care through Medicaid. They're going to destroy rural hospitals. Why? They're going to take that money and give it to their friends and donors. Link the two. Give motive and don't get off of this. Don't talk about it and make these votes come up. And these votes are going to come up. They're going to have to take these votes. And if they do, make them pay maximum penalty. I'm beginning to think they might not be able to put it together. They just may not be able to get all, they're not going to get any Democrats. Now, I don't think any Democrat is even tempted to be for any of this. That's a non-starter if you ever saw one. So make them pay. Make them fight for every vote. Make them pay for every vote. Make every Republican pay that goes in there and stay focused on this. You feel free to start swinging, but be targeted. Go right for the jaw. And the jaw is ordinary people paying for tax cuts for rich people when ordinary people don't have anything to pay and rich people have too much. Nothing could be simpler. Nothing. Nothing should get in the way of this. Nothing.
James, I would say both you and I thought this was going to be bad. We're not surprised that it's really, really bad the first 101 days. There was one thing that I did miscalculate on. I thought surrounding himself with nothing but loyalists and sycophants, that there would be less chaos because they're, you know, they would all say, yes, sir, whatever you want. There's more. What I neglected is when you tap incompetent people to take jobs, by definition, they're going to produce chaos because they don't know what the hell they're doing. We see that at the Pentagon. We see that at the IRS. We see that at HHS. We see that in other places. And this, if anything, is a more chaotic administration than Trump 1.0.
So, of course, it's been, you know, we think we can imagine it bad. We imagine it really bad. It's actually been worse than we imagined. But when it started, there was a 5% feeling that people had, Democrats had, You know, he's inheriting a pretty good economy, actually. Uh-huh. It might, who knows, it could get better. They couldn't screw it up. Some chance some of this might work. Well, we now know there was no chance it would ever work. It's been bigger than we could even imagine. In fact, you know, you look at the news and it gets so bad, you say, well, this is bad for Trump. But the United States has had a bad 101 days. And boy, I can't imagine. I think this thing, we talked about it on the phone. I think this thing in Canada is call it a political earthquake.
Yeah, let me pick up on that, because I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it was a big deal. 3 months ago, Reliable Poll had the Conservatives up 27 points. Trudeau stepped down. This guy, Mark Carney, took over. He was going to be the Kamala Harris, because the party was very unpopular, and they still were going to lose. And then something happened. What was it, James? You and I know. It was Donald Trump. And Donald Trump cost the Conservatives that election. Carney won by 2.5 points, more than Trump won, by the way. The Conservative leader lost his seat. And I think you and I have talked about this. This is a harbinger. It's not just Canada. It's alliances around the world. People don't think America can be trusted anymore. And I think that Canadian election was terribly important. And one final point, Jill Abramson pointed us to a report by Bridgewater, a big hedge fund company that, you know, pretty smart people. And they say the Trump policies, and I'm quoting Bridgewater, imperils the existing world order. This is really, really bad.
Well, yeah, I could go on and quote Howard Marks at Oak Tree or any number of other people that say that the whole international trading system, the whole status of the dollar, that's how bad it mm-hmm. is, okay? Mm-hmm. Let's go back to Canada. I've been working in international politics since 1993. I cannot remember, and in front of our listeners can help me, we'll be glad to read your letter, that any time in a democracy, a unpopular incumbent government has a 27-point lead going 3 months before the election.
A disadvantage.
The election by 2.5.
Yeah.
I don't believe that anything like that remotely has ever happened. I have seen instances where an unknown comes up and really charges and picks up a lot of points. That's eminently possible. When you have a known government, I think it was in power for 18 years, the candidate was a completely known, he was like the chair of the Federal Reserve Bank. All right, he was the status quo on steroids. You couldn't be any more status quo than Carney was. Yet he wins the thing. And the only explanation that you could possibly come up with, it was Donald Trump. And you know, I understand there's a border. Canadians have a different tradition. They have different customs than Americans. They have always been our best ally, one of our favorite countries. But they're not that different than us. And the fact that this happened is really underappreciated. It's significant. Now, we'll see what happens, because our next big test, and I keep coming back to this, is Virginia. And they're falling apart, and we just got to really bring it home on these tax cuts and on these cuts to Medicaid, health, you know, weather, you name it. I mean, they're destroying they're not just destroying themselves in a Republican Party. They are trying to destroy the United States of America. I believe that.
Well, James, you're right. And let me just stay on the global thing for a minute. About 3 years ago, we went to a very small dinner party. There were three ambassadors there from American allies, two from Asian countries, one from Europe. And they all said, this is 2022, I think, the end of it. They said their home offices would ask one central question. Is America's return to normalcy permanent? Or, as one said, assess the likelihood of a Trump-type return. They didn't get a Trump-type return. They got Trump. And he's changing the world order to America's destrum. And the second anecdote is, about 12 years ago, we went over to Vietnam on a vacation. And our friend Tommy Valley, who's a Marine veteran, critical in repairing relations with that country, insisting we see their top officials. James, it was stunning. They all want America support. They all saw America as a buffer to China. They could be an important ally, and they've tried. They got a crummy government, but they've been an important ally in Asia. Trump is going to drive them back to China. That's what he's doing. And in 2028, if we elect a Wes Moore and Andy Beshear and Alyssa Slotkin, cause for great celebration. But you know, our long national nightmare won't be over. It's going to take years, maybe decades, to repair the damage that Trump is inflicting.
I think when historians or archaeologists or whatever in the future start asking themselves what happened to the dominant nation in the world, when they unearth it, I think part of it will start with the Trans-Pacific Pact, which was everybody, every Pacific nation from Chile to the United States to Canada, Japan, South Korea, Thailand, Vietnam, New Zealand, I can't name all the countries, that decided to form a trading bloc to deal with the Chinese. So they wanted to like beat the Chinese. And of course, Trump stupidly took us out of it. I mean, really stupid. So they're saying, well, so now they've done this. We have come together to try to form a trade bloc. We've really pissed the Chinese off. Now we're sitting here naked. Then they come with this whole crap that puts the whole trading system, the predominance of the dollar, every trade agreement we ever made, and they're starting to cut separate deals. Like, we can't depend on these people. And right. If countries have to, they'll cut a deal with an odious country like China. And people are starting to do that. And it's hard to blame them because they'll say, we don't know what the United States is going to do. These people are goddamn crazy. And we're going to pay for this. You're going to pay for it at the checkout counter. You're going to pay for it with your mortgage rates. You're going to pay for it when you go abroad and try to spend a dollar. We're going to pay for this. And we have got to take this regime and we got to just clobber them to show that's not what the United States is. That I know it's a long wait, but I don't know what happens when this guy is. I think there's a good chance he's just going to fail by the end of the summer.
Well, James, if he does, the senior senator from South Carolina has a solution. He is pushing Donald Trump to be the next pope. I know. Huh? What do you think of it, James?
I thought when a friend of mine told me, I started laughing. And then I read what Lindsey Graham said. I mean, this is a question. Okay, so I don't much care for Lindsey Graham's politics. He seems, on the surface, I know him, a kind of an affable guy. Does this man have any sense of self-dignity? Does he have any sense of, you know, I adhere to conservative principles, I like to do this, I don't want to make a fool of myself. I just don't understand it. I would love for him to explain what the fuck were you thinking? That, I mean, and I, you wanted to say, well, maybe he did it as a spoof. No, if you read it, you've had the feeling this fool was really serious about this. In no sense of, like, if I did something like that, man, I couldn't face my kids. I don't know what I'd do.
Well, I've said this before, but Christopher Buckley, the brilliant writer, and one of his novels has Lindsey Graham in it, and his name is Squiggly T. Biscuit. It seems to me that's even more appropriate today. But in any event,
Biscuit has some value, but it's good. It's a good description. But it's just stunning how human beings and just lose all dignity, all self-awareness, all principle, all anything. It's just stunning.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, at some point, man, my question to Lindsey Graham is, for what? What did you get out of it? Okay, you stayed in the United States Senate. You had a driver. You had a staff. And you, you, You're gonna.
That's all he has, James. It's his whole life. He has nothing else. He has nothing else, and that's actually sad.
Let me tell you something about the Naked Ones. This is something I know a little bit about. And just so you know what they do, they go to all these producers. They get the best possible price. They have people that really know wine. They actually, and it's different wines. There's different varietals. And I think you get like, it's like $6.50 a bottle, which is unheard of. And I'm going to tell you, but every one that they choose is a wine that I like because people have different tastes, but you get to taste different wines. They're all good, and some are really, really good. The people that do this know what they're doing. I promise you, they know what they're doing.
Summer's coming, and it's time to start living well. And with those social engagements coming up, our next partner can help you show up with a story around how you found the best, most interesting wine from independent winemakers with a truly unique story, as you suggest, James. Thanks to Naked Wines. This podcast is sponsored by Naked Wines. Stop shopping for wine like it's 2005 and embrace quality and convenience. Naked Wines directly connects you to the world's finest independent winemakers so you can get award-winning wine delivered straight to your door. Use our code WARROOM for the code and password at nakedwines.com and get their incredible deal of 6 bottles for just $39.99. James, that's less than $7 a bottle. I can do that, Matthew.
Yeah, and let me tell you, the people that select these wines, they go out, they taste them, they get the best price, they buy in bulk, and they know what they're doing. And for $7 a bottle of wine, you're not going to do any better than this.
Absolutely. You know, it's difficult to go to the store being paralyzed by the wine options and prices. Now you get exactly what you want and have ditch road trips to the store for good. Plus, Naked Wines help you take any meal to the next level with the perfect bottle for any occasion. Thanks to Naked Wines, you can share an amazing steak dinner paired with a 2021 Matt Parrish Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon. It's one to remember. And the best part, every bottle is a passion project from an independent winemaker. So you are literally making independent winemakers' dream come true. Now, how do they do it? Naked Wines connects winemakers and wine drinkers directly, allowing for vineyard-to-your-door delivery at up to 60% off what you would pay in store by cutting out the traditional retail middleman costs and markups. Winemakers can pass those savings on to you without skimping on quality. Now is the time to join the Naked Wines community. Head to nakedwines.com/warroom, click Enter Voucher, and put in our code WARROOM for both the code and password for 6 bottles of wine for just $39.99 with shipping included. That's $100 off your first 6 bottles. NakedWines.com/WARROOM and use the code and password WARROOM for 6 bottles of wine for $39.99. The link is in our show notes.
Find the perfect wine for any moment with Naked Wines.
Hey, James, our guest is Ryan Lizza, one of the best Washington political reporters for the past 20 years. The New Yorker in the last 6 years is chief Washington correspondent for Politico. Last month, he left saying mainstream media like Politico really may not be up to the challenge of covering Trump. He is starting his own digital site, and I'm going to get it right. It's Telus News. You got that?
Telus News,
Ryan,
yeah.
And in only a week has broken some big stories. Ryan is also not without controversy. Ryan, tell us why you believe that mainstream media, you cited Politico, aren't up to the Trump challenge and why your startup may be.
Well, you know, when you use the term mainstream media, it brings in a lot of different people and institutions. And I do think it's important to be really, really specific because there's a lot of crap in, you know, what people think of as mainstream media. And there's a lot of, you know, great stuff. Like, you know, like I know a lot of people who bash the Times. I'm not a New York Times basher. I think the New York Times is the best journalistic institution right now.
I'm not
covering
either.
The Trump.
It's great.
You know, I have all kinds of specific pieces I could complain about, but their coverage of the Trump administration is excellent and I think should be, you know, modeled at other places. The way I think about this is we have conventions in journalism that are really, really important. And we have ideals and principles. And the conventions have to follow the ideals and the principles. And when someone sort of figures out how to pick the lock of our conventions and kind of weaponize them against us, well, you got to go back to first principles, ideals, and figure out, okay, what are we doing wrong here that's allowing them to make our coverage not quite as clear not allow us to explain as clearly to the audience what's actually going on. I think that's the sort of broad way to think about it, is that a lot of political reporters, especially people like me who got into this business because we loved people like James Carville and, you know, when we were in college in the 90s and watching, those great elections. And we love polls and strategy and all that fun stuff. And we're not really living exactly in that era anymore. And we haven't been for a long, long time. And it requires a little bit of an adjustment just to sort of level set about like what the basics are in terms of the power structure in Washington and in American politics. And
Ryan, yeah. I'm going to get to some of the big stories you've broken already. But first, Politico, I think you said that you only had 3 months and you signed a non-disclosure agreement. And I think they've issued a cease and desist order and threatened legal action. Where does that stand?
Well, let me tell you what. Last week, what happened was on Monday, I wrote an 1,800-word article that was about a few things. One, it was about, hey, I'm starting this new venture called TELUS News. Two, it was some criticism of the style that I just talked about in that first question. And in a couple of examples, mentioned Politico. Very mild, normal criticism. You can't critique political journalism in Washington without talking about the biggest institutions. And then most of the article, Al, was about what the Trump administration forced Paul Weiss to do and how Paul Weiss went and sort of memory holed all of this information on their website. That was a big chunk of it. And so there was some criticism of Politico in there. Did not disparage them, did not violate any contract language, I assure you. And you have to remember, Politico didn't say any of what you just said on the record. They won't. And you have to remember that sometimes these contracts have clauses in them where you're not allowed to acknowledge the existence of the contract. So if there was a contract, I might not be able to even tell you about it.
Did they issue a cease and desist order?
I'll tell you what they did. They sent the lawyer there called me in a panic at 7 o'clock on Monday night and said I needed to take it down immediately. And then followed up with a letter saying I needed to take down the entire 1,800-word article without referencing a single line in the article, without saying, here's why we think it's disparaging or whatever, or here's why we want a correction. They just said, take the whole thing down. And I thought, this is fucking crazy. I'm not going to take this down. This article isn't even about them. Why? What kind of like petty narcissism is this that they've decided this whole article is about them? And they sort of inserted themselves into this in a way that I frankly didn't want them to be. So I had to explain, no, I'm not doing that. And that's where it all started. It's all started with them making a very, very unreasonable demand to take down an 1,800-word article that was not about them, but had a few lines that they didn't like. And then we had a whole bunch of back and forths all last week, frankly, pretty silly. And by the end of the week, they were in the position of asking me to take down basically three different articles and a part of another article.
I must tell you, I don't know the specifics, but I invariably side against those people who are trying to censor. I think that censorship, and that's what they're engaged in. Let me talk about that. You mentioned the law firm. It was about Ginni Rhee, who was a great Watergate, or excuse me, Watergate. She was a great Mueller prosecutor. Yeah. And she prosecuted, was it the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers,
well,
or both?
When she was working for Mueller, she prosecuted some of the Trump campaign officials, which is why they went after her. Now, interestingly,
Roger Stone being one of them.
Manafort, Papadopoulos. Right.
And didn't they have on their site, proudly, these were Ginny Reed's accomplishments, including those, and even the Proud Boys or Oath Keepers.
There are two things. If you go, it's still there in the Internet Archive. If you go to her original bio on her page, the first thing in her experience section is all about her time as a top prosecutor in the Justice Department prosecuting, working on the Russia investigation for Mueller, right? Then in 2020 and 2021, she had all this stuff about these Proud Boys, these two Proud Boys cases she worked on. She deleted all of that from her bio after Trump targeted them with the executive order, which
I assume they did that to please Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. She's also working on the Google antitrust case, so it could be part of that. But you could go through the website of all sorts of attorneys over there at Paul Weiss and the firm's own history, compare the before and after. And it's really like frightening, kind of 1984 stuff of them rewriting their own history, their own values, what they say about diversity, and these poor attorneys having to give up and delete some of their proudest accomplishments in their biographies. And I will tell you, that was kind of a turning point for me in terms of like this administration and like how we cover it.
And those nine firms that just totally capitulated. And they're so damn stupid, Ryan. They don't realize when you capitulate to a bully, the bully comes back. He's back at them now for other things, and he's not going to give up. Paul Weiss and Kirkland and Ellis and all the others, they're going to be haunted for the rest of the Trump administration. And they're stuck.
For decades. And look, I don't want to try and be some martyr with this stupid thing with Politico, but I will say it was in the middle of all this other stuff and you're watching people back down and you're watching people capitulate. And I just thought, this is crazy. Like, I'm not going to like take down an article. It would have destroyed the website on day one. If our journalist saying, "Oh, okay, I'm gonna take down this criticism of Trump because Politico doesn't like one or two lines in it." So I do think there's like a contagion effect when people start standing up and people realize that nothing happens. You're still there the next day, things are a lot different now here at the end of April than they were in January in terms of people realizing how bad things are and pushing back.
James.
So, Ryan, the three of us have been around forever, and the dividing line between journalism and politics, there's a lot of interaction between the two people, right? And a lot of people in journalism say politics is really nasty. It's really gotten nasty. It's all about name-calling. I'm not sure journalism is any better in the infighting than politics. I'll be honest with you. Am I off base here? Are some of these internal fights in journalism going to be as nasty as anything I've ever seen?
Yeah, and I usually don't get involved in them, but going out and doing something independent is very liberating. And I can't get into all the details. I'll probably write about it soon. But the whole thing that happened at Politico before I left, when I think about it, it was so silly the way we dealt with it all. I'm sorry to be cryptic, but there's a lot of bullshit that goes on in these institutions and a lot of PR. And I think not in a great way, James, that some institutions that just obsess about politics,
right,
they have started to internalize the kind of the values of political operatives and campaigns, and they see everything in these kind of PR ways. And sometimes they have to remember that there is a difference between those two worlds.
Yeah, sometimes I think journalism, let's say politics, and says, "You think you can be small and petty and narrow? Just watch us. God damn it. We'll show you how to do it."
No, we're great at it. And then also, we love to talk about ourselves, so that anything that happens in our little media world gets blown up by us.
Right, right. And we'll cover ourselves. Okay.
Next thing you know, you're on 10 podcasts talking about it.
I'm stupid. Spell tell us. Just spell the name of your site because it's us. Is it? Because if I want to go to it, you got to spell it. Okay, I'm dumb like
that. Yeah,
you spell it the same way in Louisiana as you do in Washington.
That's right. It's TELOS.
TELOS.
Yeah, TELOS.
Is it a Greek derivative word? Or is it just one to make up?
It is. Your TELOS is your aim, your end, your mission.
Okay.
So it has a sort of high-minded, association, which I liked just because I think it's a good reminder. But then it also has a really silly pun, which is TELOS. Tell us news. Here's what I'm going to tell you today.
Works on multiple levels. I love it, man.
Well, I didn't realize that I'd be telling people how to pronounce it.
There's a couple things in politics. The two words that get slung around, and I hear them like, one is the establishment. And people say, the established Democrats like James Carville, what fucking establishment am I in? Have you ever looked at this guy?
Well,
yeah, the guy looks like an establishment guy. He's like at a white shoe law firm or something. And the other one that I wish you'd explain, what is the legacy media? I keep hearing legacy media. I don't even know what the fuck it is. Tell me what is the definition of legacy media?
I mean, it's
like your
daddy worked at the papers or you work at it too, or your uncle went to Princeton and you get to go to Princeton, or your aunt was a Chi Omega, so you get to be a Chi Omega. What the fuck does it mean?
I think it's anything that existed, say, pre-internet, pre-1990, I don't know, when do we think of as the internet being like a mass thing, 95, right? Like anything pre-digital. But then, institutions come along and they're around for long enough and you start to think of them as legacy media. Like, I think a lot of people think of Politico as so established now that it's almost legacy media. But I don't know, I think of it as the networks and the traditional print press.
Okay, that's a good enough definition. But as everything gets into, I have no idea what you're talking about. Everything is the establishment. And what the fuck are you even talking about here?
Well, as someone who ran an anti-establishment campaign once or twice, that when you're going after the establishment, usually what you're trying to do is just replace them.
Right. Yeah. So of course that's what you do. And that's what, when people start a news site, they aspirationally want to be the New York Times. And that's great. I mean, I don't have any fucking problem with that. So before I turn you back to Al, what is your main, is everybody has an idea of how Trump should be covered? Are we doing this right? Or should we pay attention? What's your main critique of journalism, and take it in its broadest sense of writ large or some shit people say, what is your biggest critique or observation about the coverage of Trump so far in this administration?
A lot of the coverage has been quite good. I think my main critique is that we need to be just really, really clear about what's going on. And just as a starting point, that this is an administration that is weaponizing the government against its perceived enemies. That's the story in Washington, as far as I'm concerned, and that's sort of the space that TELUS News wants to dominate. I think just the sort of brain dead traditional problems that political journalism has had for a long time now, that Trump has taken advantage of, are the same, so mystery. It's the same stuff. It's the both sidesism. It's the, if Trump tomorrow says his goal is to, round up people and put them in camps, in the Southwest, there'll be some outrage coverage for a couple of days. And then the political press will just start covering that as like whether he's accomplishing his goal or not, So it's like, no matter what, that to me is a sort of like the idiot horse race coverage, which is fine if you're covering a horse race like a campaign, but when you apply that to politicians in Washington in terms of whether they're succeeding, winning, or losing, and you totally lose sight of any kind of subjective analysis about what the goal is, that's what sort of I think drives me crazy. I'll give you a small example. There's a newsletter out there that started when Doge came about, and it's called, it's about the transformation of the federal government. Now, is that the best description of what's going on with the federal government? The transformation? I don't know. There's just a lot of, I don't think it is. Or these headlines you see with, Trump's next target in his campaign against the law firms. It's a sort of normalizing a lot of stuff that needs coverage about why it's not normal, actually. And you're sort of taking at you're allowing the Trump administration to sort of set the terms of debate in a way that I think deserves a little bit more pressure. I mean, and people say, "Oh, well, that's partisan. That's Well, no, we make editorial judgments all the time in journalism, every single day.
So, you said Big Balls is not a transformer.
I mean, it's just like you just kind of put things into this. Here's what I think.
I want to meet Big Balls.
I'm going to excerpt that. That's what I'm going to use to promote this show. Al Hunt saying that, but like. I lost my train of thought now. So anyway, let's.
That's okay. Yeah, can I jump in, James? I tell you what, really, I've been in this business a long, long time, and I have never been so worried about corporate ownership. I look at what Jeff Bezos has done to the Washington Post. I saw the other day where he put on his Amazon, they had a site that talked about how much tariffs increased any product. Trump blasted him. He took it down. So if Trump doesn't like a Washington Post story, I don't trust Jeff Bezos anymore. Disney and ABC already capitulated a case that they couldn't have lost, I don't think. And CBS is about to surrender on an absurd 60-minute charge. So, I mean, basically, the people that are doing good work, I mean, I think independent people like you, the Times does not have what I consider a corporate ownership. The only corporate ownership that I worked for Dow Jones, they were fabulous. Mike Bloomberg, actually, I think I would trust, but not many. It really has gotten, the LA Times, I think, is now capitulating. That changes the whole nature of the business, Ryan.
Totally. I've been talking about this a lot this week and last week. I was never one of these people that would rail and about, you can't trust ABC because Disney owns them. Or, there were, when I went to UC Berkeley and, I remember taking some media classes, and one of the core texts you would study was by a guy named Ben Bagdikian. And Ben's entire thing was about, you can't trust the media because big corporations own it. And I always thought we can point to problems in the last few decades of corporate ownership kind of reaching into the newsroom and trying to meddle. But for the most part, there has been a very good separation of church and state in most of these institutions, one of the great journalistic conventions of the 20th century. And what has totally changed in just a few months is Donald Trump has used the power of the regulatory state to actually pressure the corporate owners and push them to reach into the newsrooms. So he's found this lever that most presidents wouldn't dare to pull. And that's, we've got, it started with ABC giving $15 million over that ridiculous lawsuit against Stephanopoulos. Now here we are with CBS. But that's the big difference, is the reason not to trust Bezos or some of these other corporate owners is they are at the mercy of the Trump administration in a lot of ways because of the nature of their business. And Trump's not afraid of using that leverage.
You ought to point out that the charges he makes are absolutely absurd.
60
minutes,
crazy.
He disagrees with the editing. First of all, the editing was perfectly fine, actually. But even if it wasn't, it's not the government's role. Conservatives used to say it's not the government's role to decide that. But they, and same with the law firms. I mean, these law firms didn't violate Foreign Corrupt Practices Act or anything. They just had lawyers who worked for people that Trump didn't like.
You know what really concerns me about all this is we're here in 2025. A lot of the loudest voices against what's going on are Democrats, no doubt about it. What's it going to be like in 20 years? Yeah, you guys know the history when one party, when one set of actors in politics pushes a boundary. It doesn't take that much longer for the other party to say, for a person who's a teenager or in their 20s in politics right now, yelling at Cargill, calling him the establishment, and saying, you know what? We should do the exact same thing when we're in power. If Trump did it, we can do it. And I hate to say it, but...
You tell your kids, you got to tell the truth.
But that's what's going to happen if you don't...
George Washington and the cherry tree. But that, now lying is a way of life.
But that's why it's the press's job to police this stuff. So right. We happen to... The press has to be happens to be on the same side as a lot of Democrats right now, and it makes us seem, you know, aligned. And there's some truth to that, because we're pointing out a lot of bad shit that's happening. I think there are a lot of Democrats, especially younger Democrats, who are going to look at this and say, you know what? That boundary was crossed. We're going to do the same fucking thing when we get in power. We're going to put some crazy FCC person in there. We're going to find ways to regulate speech through the regulatory state. And that's what worries me, is that the other side adopts this stuff. And we saw it, frankly, with Biden. You could defend what he did, perhaps, on some of the pardons, but because of what Trump did, there was an argument available to Biden to say, you know what, I'm going to do this too. And that's how it starts.
Do you think any
Democrat is going to keep Bongino in as, Kash Patel in as FBI director? No. So that's another norm violated, right? They're supposed to be there for 10 years.
Let me ask you a final question and turn it back to James. You're on Substack. What kind of a start are you off to?
I would say within 6 hours on Monday, a week ago yesterday, when I started this whole thing, the immediate thought I had with the sort of hitting all the goals we had established for that day and realizing what it was going to look like going forward, I sent Hamish McKenzie, the co-founder of Substack, I said, you have built an incredible platform here. I wish I had done this years ago. And Al, all I'm getting is emails and texts from friends at Politico and the Times and the Post saying, how do I do this? You know, can we team up? And so we want to build this out into a larger institution and try and be a place.
We have to talk to you about that, because I'm a subscriber, but James and I went on Substack. They said, we'll give you all kinds of help. To be honest, we failed. I mean, we're still on it. It's fun, but we haven't built anything, because once we got on, they dropped us. So somehow we have to take a lesson from Ryan, Liz, and James.
Been one of the most popular political podcasts out there. I've been a loyal listener for a long time. You, with persistence, will build a big audience on there. It could be a little tricky, the platform, and it is true. You can't rely. It is. You got to do it yourself. You can't rely on them. I don't think they're really set up to fully, you know, launch and keep and cater to all the.
They were more bullish before we started. But anyway, yeah. James, take over.
I think there's a damning critique of Democrats and journalism, and that critique is in one fact. In the entire history of the FBI, you understand, in the entire history, there has never been a Democratic director. And has anybody ever said, wait a minute, there's something wrong here? I mean, you can't tell me, I mean, that they're not good Democratic lawyers. You just can't tell me that, all right? Yet, everybody agrees that we should have a Republican FBI director, because if we had a Democrat, the Republicans wouldn't stand for it. Okay. And the other thing I would say, and I will say this repeatedly, people say to me all the time, James, why don't we just do like the Republicans do, just stand up and lie? Because our fucking people wouldn't stand for it. If I stood up and lied, you would be the first person to say, James Carville lost all credibility last night when he said X, Y, and Z. Yeah, I can spin. I can shade. Everybody does that. They just, like, look you right in the eye and lie. And then our people say, well, we ought to lie like them. No, we shouldn't, because they would not do that. It would not go over well. If a Democrat appointed, I couldn't imagine a comparable Democrat to Kash Patel, the New York Times has come out of the woodwork.
You don't think we have a PHEX
editorial saying, what are the Democrats doing if they lost their way? There is a double
standard.
I'm sorry. Yeah. There is one, and the greatest manifestation of it, there has never been a Democratic FBI director, and there's never been a call to have one.
I do agree with you on the Democrats seem a lot more invested in the norms that are being broken these days. But I hope that continues. I hope the virus doesn't spread. But you know, most of the time in politics, when you have a weapon that both sides have agreed, you don't use that, and one side starts using it, eventually the other side says, you know what, I guess we're going to have to use this too. And if you talk to younger Democratic activists, I think they're torn. You hear a lot who just say what you just say, like, we'll never be like them. You know, the whole thing is but you also hear quite a few who say, these are the new rules and we're gonna push the establishment to fight that way. I think we should be worried about it. We shouldn't, I'm not saying that's the most important problem. The most important problem is covering what's going on right now with Trump. But one reason to be really outspoken about it is because if you're not, it just becomes the way of life and everyone will start doing it. And again, Biden did it with the pardons. And yes, he could make an argument for why, but usually the argument starts with, well, the other side did X, Y, and Z, so they forced us to do this.
Yeah,
Hush Patel is not going to serve in a Democratic administration. Do we agree with that, James?
Of course he won't.
Right? So then that's going to be the first, so he's not going to get the 10-year term that has been traditional. So then the norm will have been broken on both sides, right? So will that norm be in place ever again?
I hope that.
That's just a small example.
I completely understand. I get it 8 times a day in every airport, okay? It's not like, why don't we do what they do? I think the better, maybe I'm a dreamer, maybe I'm stupid, maybe I'm naive, but maybe as opposed to us lying like them, maybe they could start telling somewhat the truth. And it's not like, and you have these fact checkers, all right? And if you talk to them, they go out of their way to try to find something to fact check a Democrat on. Because it would be 100-1 if they didn't do it. And they'll all tell you that. Okay? They're just dying for anything so they can sort of look objective. But if you're going to pay attention to who tells the truth, it's not on the other hand. It's on the other pinky finger.
I agree with you there. There's a huge asymmetric imbalance between the two parties. And reporters in Washington wish it were 2014, wish it were before June of 2015, or at least, and wish that this era didn't exist. I mean, I compared it in this piece to, I have a friend who served in Iraq, and he was in this group that just constantly had new recruits because they were getting killed all the time. And so he watched a lot of new soldiers come in and face warfare for the first time. And he had this very astute point about how the first time they were in full combat, it was so horrific, so unlike anything they'd ever experienced, that one of the common reactions is just to deny it, to like deny that like what's actually happening is happening. And that's how I feel a lot of newsrooms are in Washington and a lot of law firms, is people don't want to admit that what is happening is actually happening, that what Trump is doing is as bad as it is, as anti-democratic. And I think once you sort of like get, and you, I'm not, you know, I'm preaching to the choir in a certain sense here, but I do think there's a lot of people in Washington that still think that way and still think that, well, if I fact checked Trump today, I got to go fact check, Schumer. Today, even though one is known for literally having no relationship to the truth when he speaks, and the other's a typical politician. And this the false equivalence problem, which I thought, we've been talking about that for so long. Like, I can't believe that it's still an issue, but it is.
It's a bigger issue than ever. Well, listen, you have been a great guest, and James and I are both going to subscribe to Tell Us News. Everybody out there, this is a guy who we're envious of because he's succeeding on Substack. But Tell Us News.
Tell Us News.
TELOS.
One plug. News. I have a 9,000-word piece that I hope your listeners will check out.
I started, Ryan. Long. I haven't finished.
It's very long. And the thing is, the payoff.
All I know is that the lawyer is a bad guy. That's clear.
The payoff is all at the end. So you got to get to the end. So I've had a couple of people who have called or emailed and said they loved the piece. And I started talking about it. And I realized they didn't make it to the end because
you can't send us the cliff
Cliff's Notes. Shit happens at the end. And I realized, like, oh, they didn't get to the end.
Hey, best of luck to you. Come back sometime. We've enjoyed this. Thank you, Brian.
Anytime, guys.
All right, James, in the second Trump era, how important is public news to stay as measured and balanced like NPR?
Well, I mean, it's not that. Some of this program they have is really remarkable. The coverage of books, the economic coverage, that's some of the best economic coverage I've read. The film critic, TV critic, all top flight. And I think that any reasonable person that goes to a variety of sites to gather her or his news would do well to go to NPR. I think some of the stuff that they do is utterly brilliant. It's innovative. And I firmly believe that both it and PBS perform a vital mission. And where they perform a particularly vital mission is in rural America, small town America, that don't have access to this kind of stuff. It's really, and if you, the better NPR networks that I found, like West Virginia Public Radio, is really, really good.
Oh, it's fabulous. I think that was started by Sharon Rockefeller many years ago. And our guest last week, Andy Beshear, talked about how important it was in rural Kentucky.
Right. And I know the Louisiana people are really good.
Yeah.
I do their programming like once a month. But where NPR really shines and where it needs support is they bring not just political news, but cultural news, you know, really big to people who just don't have access to it, like people in more urban areas take for granted. And I think it's a very justified use of public money to support these things.
Well, the pace of change is faster than ever. And that means you need to stay up to date on developments in the world. It can be overwhelming to take it all in. But NPR hones in on what's most important and gives it to you straight. That's why James and I deeply respect the NPR Politics podcast as a place to go for us all to decode what's going on in Washington and what the decisions they're making and the Capitol might mean for you and me. The NPR Politics podcast team will focus on one thing and boil it down to 15 minutes or less. Think of it as your political multivitamin or a shot of bourbon, depending on your taste. After listening, we can hit the ground running knowing that we got the most critical news of the day. Whether you're writing a piece or just trying to understand the world around you, NPR has what you're looking for on their network. One of our other favorites is State of the World. It takes you on a journey across the planet so you can dive deeper into the forces driving our shared future. Don't wait. Tune in and listen now to the NPR Politics Podcast, only from NPR, wherever you get your podcast. Have a listen.
Do you ever look at political headlines and go, huh? Well, that's exactly why the NPR Politics Podcast exists. We're experts, not just on politics, but in making politics make sense. Every episode, we decode everything that happened in Washington and help you figure out what it all means. Give politics a chance with the NPR Politics Podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.
The links are in our show notes. All right, and now for the outrage of the week. You know, one of the Trump presidency's, quote, innovations, end quote, is to democratize the White House press corps. You know, really kind of sublimating the role of organizations like the Associated Press and bringing in social media fans who ask searching questions like, and I'm going to just read them. One of them asked the press secretary, does the administration have any comment on leftist state and local officials denying ICE and Trump's deportation efforts? Man, that is a tough one. Another one was, can you release the president's fitness plan? He looks healthier than ever. Is he working out with Bobby Kennedy? That's something that all of America is interested in knowing. But, you know, my favorite, which I got from the Drudge Report, is that one of the influencers that Ms. Leavitt brought in was a woman named Cambry Nelson, who recently suggested, I'm not making this up, James, she suggested that the moon was missing for 7 days. The moon just disappeared. And finally, she located it, but there was some controversy over its color when they finally found it. But thank goodness she has found the moon, and thank goodness, move over Peter Baker and move over Caitlin Collins. We got the Moon Brigade coming in to take over the White House press briefings.
It gets worse and worse and worse. And it's very justified. For my outrage, I want to talk about the Democrats, and I want to talk about David Hogue. David Hogue said what I thought and called out was a really stupid, pathetic thing. He was a vice chair at the DNC. He was elected. And he said he was going to raise $20 million to primary certain Democrats. I said, that's an outrage. You can't make a long story short. I did an appearance of David Hogue yesterday. He is a 25-year-old guy. He's very passionate. He's very smart. He said a stupid thing. Okay. And now the DNC is now talking about a candidate who failed a Democratic National Committee leadership is challenging her defeat. The first threat to DNC vice chair, David Hogue, vowed to keep backing the same party on the incumbent. Okay. The Credentials Committee will be on May 12th to consider a challenge from Caitlin Free, a Native American attorney and party activist, as well as vice chairman, brought to David Hogue at the party's February 1st meeting. In her complaint, shared with Semaphore by a Democratic source, Free argued she would lost a totally flawed election that violated DNC charter and discriminated against three women of color candidates, and asked for two new vice chair elections in February after several rounds of voting. The race came down to five candidates. Kenyatta, Hogue, Free, and two other women, Kenyatta and Hogue, claimed the open spots. All right? By aggregating votes across the DNC process by its own charter and bylaws, Free filed a challenge on February 20th. Members informed yesterday it would be taken up February 12th. Are we really going to do this? Are we really going to? We just got clobbered with young people. We got clobbered by males. We got clobbered by identity politics. And you're going to wade right back into this? Jesus Christ, has anybody ever learned anything? David Hogue made a mistake. Ken Martin should call him in, reading the Riot Act, pass a resolution saying you can't do this, and get on with life. But if we're going to chase every goddamn 25-year-old that says some jackass thing out of the party and under the grounds of some allocated positions based on gender or ethnicity or whatever the fuck they do. We're just doing the same thing. We never learn. Well, we never learn.
I don't know how it happened. You're right about it. It's just terrible. And he may have an excuse, but it makes Chairman Ken Martin look really bad. He better somehow come up with some way to correct this.
He better. You know, I tell you, if they do this, look, you can do this kind of stuff and maybe you're motivated by it. You saw what happened, all right? You saw what happened with young voters. You saw what happened to male voters. You saw what happened, the staggering unpopularity of this. And you're going to go right back into it? I mean, come on. I mean, I wait and see what Ken Martin says. But man, he better get this thing settled.
A lot of pressure on you.
Yeah, a lot of pressure,
Chairman Martin. Yeah. We're gonna revisit this in ensuing weeks. You know, James, with Trump's war on immigrants and our tradition of co-equal branches of government, how important is it to understand the morality and legality of justice and the upkeep and care of a modern democracy, James?
Oh, well, nothing counts more when something's at risk. I mean, things that we've taken for granted most of our lives are now at risk and jeopardy. I don't know how you can be a good citizen and not be on top of all of this. It's always been critical, but it's beyond being critical now. It goes to show you can't take anything for granted.
Understand the stakes and fight back with Kimberly Atkins-Store on her Politicon podcast, Justice by Design. I've gotten to know Kimberly Atkins-Store, and James, she is really good.
Absolutely. And, you know, I got to say, it's not important that you listen. It's critical. And, you know, you get this kind of information and a person like this, and, you know, had this kind of life, this kind of experience, until it screams at you that you, this is something that you want to listen to, this is something you want to learn from. It's information that you really need.
Level up and tune in by watching Justice by Design on the Politicon YouTube channel or listening to it on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. The link is also in our show notes. And now for our listener questions. They have risen to this occasion, James. I'm going to start with New Orleans. Red in New Orleans. You got a lot of reds in New Orleans. Red, Big Red says, why won't the media cover Trump's health remotely like they dogged Biden's stutter?
I think some of the coverage of Biden, I think he kind of overcame stuttering.
I don't think the stutter was the issue with Biden's health.
I know people that deal with that, but it's very difficult. They're very crazy. I admire Biden. I think what's going to happen here is the Jake Tapper book, and we got a request for Jake. I think we'll get him on exactly when, about all the people that knew about Biden's cognitive issues, to say the least. But let me tell you, Trump is not that young. And, you know, there are people I think that say he's having processing issues. And I'm not sure about bringing attention to this. And it was a failure to adequately cover Biden's cognition issues. I think there's obviously, when we see it now, we're going to see more, that it was a failure within the White House. But I think this may draw more attention to Trump and his age and his issues also. So let's see. But, you know, I don't think his coverage of his stuttering was.
No, I agree. It was his cognitive decline. I think I mentioned this before. I had a very eminent neurologist say to me, you know, Trump covers it up with, you know, kind of his bombast and everything. Right. That's not a test of whether someone is slipping or not.
No.
So I do think the press ought to cover it. We have Kevin in Vashon Island, Washington, says, isn't it true that at this point Trump doesn't care about poll numbers? No, it is not true, Kevin. Trump follows poll numbers. He gets daily reports from his pollsters. Of course, he lies about them. I'm not sure his pollsters give him numbers if they are bad. But if those numbers should go up, I don't think they will, but if they should, you can rest assured Trump will be talking about it every day.
The one poll he does pay attention to is Fox. And he pays attention to Fox coverage. And he gets really mad about it.
And yeah, because they have a pretty good poll.
Actually, their polls are slightly more, they're bad for him. They're all bad. They're all really bad.
Yeah.
On every internal dynamic he was behind on every issue, taxes, economy, you name it, the only one he was slightly ahead of was the border. And other folks said he's behind. But he follows the Fox polls. He follows Fox. He doesn't, I don't think he gives, and he does follow the Times. He does it. That was his hometown newspaper. I don't think he gives a shit, what the Reuters poll says.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. James, Michael in Brooklyn, New York, starts off by saying, I love you. I think he's talking about you. Oh. But I believe that you are grossly underestimating, Michael says, the impact that Bernie Sanders and AOC are having on working Americans. The crowds they draw on their oligarchy tour were absolutely enormous. How can we deny that?
Well, I'm not going to deny that because I can see the crowds. First of all, I think the term oligarchy tour is stupid. People don't use that language in everyday life. Most people do not. Most people say fat cats, billionaires, big shots. Secondly, Bernie Sanders has run twice as a Democrat for president. He lost both times. He lost more the second time. When have any of these people ever run in a competitive place and beat a Republican? Now, it's not crowd size that counts. It's votes that count. So, yes, there's energy. Yes, they have a a deep, but I would argue relatively limited following among Democratic primary voters. And they never win an election, and they never run against a Republican. So Bernie represents, according to the Cook PVI, and I looked it up, the most Democratic-lean state in the union. It's not as big a lean as the District of Columbia, but it's the biggest lean of any state. AOC's district is, I want to say, plus 25, plus 27 Democrats. Great. They can't lose. They can't lose. But why do we pay more attention to them than we pay to Alyssa Slotkin or Ruben Gallego or Raphael Warnock or people that run in states that it's hard to win elections and they win elections? And what they're not asking AOC to come in and campaign for. I bet you that. I bet you that the Abigail Scranberger does not bring AOC into Virginia to campaign with her. I just bet you.
Yeah, I think you're right. John in Gurnee, Illinois, I think John's a repeat questioner, which is always welcome. He says, I'm too young to remember McCarthyism, but in your opinion, is MAGA headed for the same ending? I've actually talked to Larry Tye a lot about this, who wrote, I think, you know, as good a biography as of Joe McCarthy as anyone. I think there's one thing that's profoundly different and one thing that is similar. The thing that's similar is that 70 years from now, Donald Trump will be held by history in disrepute as Joe McCarthy is now. Now, even worse. The thing that's different is Joe McCarthy was a senator, a powerful, a dangerous senator, and it lasted for 4 years. Donald Trump runs the entire government, and the damage will be greater, and it will be even more enduring.
Well, I think you're correct. I know you know this subject. I know it's something that you follow. It's something you're passionate about, and I think you know, from what I know, your analysis was spot on. It was a terrible time in America, but it was just one senator, but basically a congressional committee. And it wasn't
right.
Much more. This is the entire United States government. And I just want to say this in comparison to McCarthy, and you keep hearing this, well, you can't compare him to Hitler. Why not? At what time, at what point, after you have Ed Martin, the appointee for the United States Attorney for the District of Columbia, which is a major presidential appointment, who's all tied up with all of these people. You have Trump's wife under oath saying that he kept Mein Kampf on his bedstand. You have Trump saying he wanted to be a dictator from day one. You have Trump siding against the Western alliance. You have an express admiration for autocrats. All right. You have Elon Musk, who is the most influential person in his administration, his biggest donor, saying Hitler wasn't responsible for the Holocaust. It was government employees. You have him endorsing the AfD party, which is a fancy word for the new neo-Nazi party in Germany. How much goddamn evidence do you need?
And you're forgetting inviting the Holocaust denier to Mar-a-Lago for dinner.
Yeah, he had the Holocaust liar, actually, Ye and Fuentes,
right,
at Mar-a-Lago for dinner. And this is the great bullshit excuse. Well, he didn't know. You're going to tell me that the ex-president, somebody's going to come up and have dinner with him, that they don't have a name or a check? That's all bullshit. So do I have to? So according to certain people, you can't compare Trump to Hitler until he actually becomes Hitler. Why don't we ask Ann Applebaum or Timothy Snyder or any of these people that studied this? Are there parallels here? Is there something that we should look at? Is there something we should study? Or should we just play dead and act like the period 1933 to 1945 never happened in world politics? These are the people that drive me crazy. No, it's not too much. It's not a bridge too far. And you don't wait until somebody actually becomes this. You do it before. That whole argument is one that I think we should engage. Yes, it is fair to make Hitlerian comparisons to Trump and the people around him. I'm sorry. It just is.
No, I completely agree. James, the next question, across the pond, Alex in The Hague, Netherlands, says, would Democrats do well to perhaps enlist candidates from outside their ranks for 2028?
I said, all right. I mean, I got, give me an idea, somebody, and I'd be totally open to it. You know, should we get a retired admiral or something like that? I guess that's what we're referring to.
It's only happened twice. One time we did pretty well, Eisenhower. The other time it's been a disaster, Trump.
Yeah, it depends on the person and circumstances. I couldn't think it was automatically a good idea or bad idea.
I think we got enough talent, James. You don't have to worry about that.
I don't think that's our problem. I think that's the greatest misdiagnosis of the Democratic problem ever, is that we need somebody from outside to save us. We have plenty internal people that are not just have the ability to save us, but have the ability, most important, to inspire us. Yeah. Inspiration is just big in politics.
James, Ken in East Orange, New Jersey says, should the House immediately impeach Trump in 2026? He means if they take control. No, Kevin. I mean, he deserves it, but stay away from it. It's not a winner. You're going to just go through the motions. There's no way you're going to get 2/3 of the Senate, I don't believe, unless something really stunning happens, which is possible. But I wouldn't have that in my game plan right now.
Well, okay, I agree. I wouldn't have it in my game plan right now. But can we imagine the shit that he's going to do? This is sort of getting ready to start in May. So we got 7 months, and then you got another 10 before the election. Well, let's look at what's happened in the first 3 months and think of, well, we got all these months between now and January 21st of 2026. You know, as of now, I agree we should impeach him, but looking into the future, I don't know.
Final question, Jay in Chicago. If the Democrats are able to reclaim the House and possibly the Senate in the 2026 midterm elections, how much authority will that majority position allow Congress to claw back from the executive branch?
I'll defer to you a little bit more procedure than me, but they would have to get 2/3 if they passed legislation, did it legislatively, he still has the power to veto.
Right, he does.
I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think that it could happen, but I think realistically, we shouldn't count on this.
I think the most significant things they can do is block bad legislation, which, you know, they're going to have trouble with anyway this year. Right. You know, maybe pass some things that'll cause Republicans to be uncomfortable. And frankly, do a lot of investigations. Do them smartly. Pick your choice. I mean, don't go wild. Just pick the most vulnerable. And there's so many vulnerable spots. And they got, you know, if people like Dan Goldman and Jamie Raskin and others are doing it, I'm going to feel pretty good about it.
Yeah, I don't think you can turn a blind eye to the massive corruption that's going on. I think that's the argument that, no, you cannot, and we started on this show before, this Mr. Garcia, you can't pivot to the price of eggs.
No question. Okay.
Give it on this criminality. No.
Please keep those letters coming in, those emails coming in. If we didn't get to yours this week, we'll try next week because we really do appreciate them. And thank you for sending them. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville. And I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Naked Wines and NPR, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content. Go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Now remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.